Americans for the Arts.
Good morning. Welcome to the Health and Nutrition Program. Dr. Fred Harvey is here. He drove up from Sarasota this morning. He's here every other Monday giving his sound advice about health and nutrition. And if you've got a comment or question for Fred, you can always email us here in the studio. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. Fred, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Rob. I'm great. How are you today?
Great seeing you. How was the drive up?
It was pretty easy until I got to the I-4-275 intersection, and it was a parking lot for about 5 minutes, which wasn't bad.
Yeah, not too bad. So I'm glad you made it. Nice to see you. So this is pollen season, and I think we probably should start there today.
Sounds like a good idea. It's everywhere.
A lot of people are sneezing.
Yes.
Any advice for folks who are really affected by the oak pollen that's in the air?
Yeah, absolutely. First thing is clean it out. Get rid of the toxin that's irritating you. So have you heard of a neti pot?
Yep.
N-E-T-I. It's a nice little Ayurvedic, like 5,000-year-old device for cleaning out your nose. You use distilled water or boiled water so you don't get any bacteria in it, and you put about a half teaspoon of a salt and baking soda mixture. That usually they sell this at the pharmacy in little pre-made packets, but if you mix two parts of sea salt and one part of baking soda together in a Tupperware, you can then take a half teaspoon of that and put it in your cup of water. Usually I heat it up a little bit so it's not quite so cold going in the head, but you don't want it really hot or you're going to burn yourself. Test it like a baby's bottle, pour some on your forearm, and you'll know it's cool enough for your nose. And then you use a whole cup to rinse out both sides of your nose. There are directions when you buy your neti pot, but it sounds weird, but you pour it in one nostril and it runs out the other nostril.
So I think I read a story a couple of days ago about somebody who misused a neti pot and
yes.
And they died from
it's
using
it. It's true.
So, okay, so what are the things to avoid in using a neti pot?
Contaminated water.
That's what it was that
yeah.
caused this
yeah,
death.
Yeah, it was coliform bacteria from tap water, and we have lots of that in all of our water around here. And so we don't want those things in our head or anywhere in our body that's not contained inside of our bowel.
That's why you use distilled water.
Exactly, because that cleans out the bacteria. And if you boil it, if you don't have a distilled water, you actually boil it, and you can boil off the chlorine from the tap water and also the bacteria.
What does the baking soda do? What does the sea salt do when you put it in your nostril?
So the sea salt at that concentration gives you what's called an isotonic solution. Iso means same as, so tonic. That's concentration. So same concentration solution as your body fluids, which makes your nose pretty happy. Now, you could add a little extra salt, like an extra quarter teaspoon, if your nose is running crazily. If it's really, really stuffed up and runny, if you put extra salt in, it's a hypertonic solution. It's very salty. It dries up your nose. So it pulls that water out and it makes it better for you. But usually, if you just want to clean out the pollen and whatever, like if you go out and work in the yard, last year, my son and I did a lot of yard work to change some landscaping, and it was so dusty that when I blew my nose, I was blowing dirt.
Yeah.
And so you want to clean that stuff out, and the neti pot's the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then other things you can do, if you really have a lot of allergy, is stabilize your mast cells. Mast cells are the cells that contain the histamine. And when they basically taste some pollen, they explode all of their histamine granules and throw them out into the environment so that your nose gets stuffy. It's
is
a
that
defense
what makes
mechanism.
Us sneeze?
Yes, it is. The histamine causes the capillaries to leak, and that makes your nose stuffy, and then it makes running happen so that you just clean out the debris. That's the whole purpose, is so that your nose runs. And so, and then sneezing to get rid of the junk. So if you don't want those symptoms to get rid of it before you get those symptoms.
Speaking of stuffy nose, is there, I know that in some Eastern traditions, they say that milk and milk products contribute to mucus and stuffy nose. Is that true?
It's quite possible. I don't think everybody responds that way, but think about the way milk has its mouthfeel. It's got kind of a mucusy texture already. There's a lot of protein in milk. So those proteins may contribute. And if you're sensitive to dairy, if you're sensitive to pollen, you might be sensitive to dairy too, because you have some cross reactions. You might then get more mucus from that too.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to stabilize the mast cells, take quercetin. The red out of red onions, the red out of red apples, or you can get it in a supplement form and take a capsule a day to stabilize those mast cells. Also, stinging nettle leaf is a really great natural antihistamine. And I love the combination of the two of those to really help clean it up. And N-acetylcysteine, a molecule that I know Eve talked about a lot, it's an amino acid that helps with detox, but it also has a really unique property of making mucus get more thin naturally. And so it works like a better version of Mucinex. So I would go to NAC 600 milligrams four times a day before I'd ever try Mucinex because of the natural way the NAC works for you.
All right, so that's N-acetylcysteine.
That's right.
And then quercetin and stinging nettles.
Right.
All right. Dr. Fred Harvey is here. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We were talking over the weekend, and you wanted to tell people about stem cells. I see all sorts of great promises about stem cells, everything from joint pain to hair restoration. I mean,
yes.
Stem cells, do they work?
Well, you said the two words, great promises. And that's really the way I look at it at this point. There's a lot of merchandising and marketing going on with it. Great stories are being told, which is the way we sell product. And frankly, there is, I think, promise for stem cells. They look like there's a good opportunity here. We're seeing some neat things with what's called embryonic stem cells, which are the most potent of all the stem cells because they come from an embryo, which is actually in the process of developing, differentiating, and growing. Stem cells are the cells before they've differentiated. So they're basically, they call them pluripotential cells. In other words, they have the potential to become any organ cell. That's why you want them, because they can develop into a liver, a brain, a heart. Anywhere you put these
cells in the body,
they actually can help repopulate it. And so there is really great promise. And we've seen the embryonic ones actually potentially working on repopulating the pancreas with insulin cells, things like that. But most of what's available today has nothing to do with that, because the American Congress has banned the use of embryonic stem cells in America. And so if you want it, you need to travel. And then you have to wonder, is it really what you're going to get there anyway? I think there are some clinics around the world that do provide real embryonic stem cells and get some results. But here we're getting a variety of products. And the safest ones are the ones that are called mesenchymal stem cells. They come from your own tissues, adult tissues. So they're not quite as potent as the embryonic ones, and they're getting some results with them. But there are no good quality clinical studies that tell us that it actually really is the answer. We're looking at it as another magic bullet. The problem is, when that happens and merchandising occurs, then we get the scary characters in the arena. And there are people out there creating stuff they call stem cell solutions or whatever, and they may not be. In fact, the FDA looked at some and found that some of these products, or many of these products, have no stem cells living, or any living cell whatsoever, inside the solution. So we don't even know what the people are getting. But the ones that I've seen local doctors doing, extracting it from your own body, they can have some effect. But again, all the clinical studies are telling us that it's looking like promise, but there's not enough data, because most of the data is from animal studies and from hypothetical studies.
So when I see a clinic advertising stem cells will do this and that, it'll cure some problem, medical problem that you have, we're really at the beginning stages of that research. Don't trust the ads that you see right now that this clinic will solve your joint problem, for instance.
Right, right. It's hopeful. It's very wishful, and you may get relief, because I've had people that have gotten relief. But you got to remember, there are 20 other ways that you can get relief that may not confer the same risk. So explore if you do have an interest in doing stem cells. I'm not trying to deter you completely, but do your research and make sure you're not being experimented on with a substance that isn't really even stem cells.
I see our phones are lighting up, and
we've got a lot
of emails. But here, let me just ask you quickly, because this is Sexually Transmitted Disease Awareness Month. What should we be considering when it comes to complementary medicine and the kind of medicine that you practice?
Well, functional medicine starts with foundations. So we got to talk about STDs. How do you get them? Unprotected sex. That simple. There's no other way. You can't get it sitting on a toilet seat. You got to actually do something active about this. And so it's really easy to be active about it. Either you abstain or you cover it. It's that simple. You don't have unprotected sex, but you should always get tested. And so, you know, we could end the HIV epidemic if everybody in this nation got tested and everybody that was positive got treated. You don't transmit the disease if you're undetectable. Undetectable means the drugs are working, and they work in nearly 100% of the cases. So we can stop this if everybody would just be willing to get tested. But the stigma around HIV is still such that it's a social onus, and it's a burden for us to actually consider it. So it's tough for people to get tested. There is a large social economic group. Actually, it's Black Americans. They've been basically benighted from knowing about this problem, and Black and Latino women have the highest increasing rates of HIV, along with young adult males who have now become invincible because they know about PrEP, this pre-exposure prophylaxis, and knowing that they can get treated and the virus won't matter. So they're all doing unprotected sex, and what we have now is a new epidemic of syphilis and gonorrhea, and now gonorrhea has even iterated a subspecies that can't be treated with antibiotics, so it's a permanent infection. So protection, test, talk, treat is the new phrase. Test or talk, test, treat.
What's the long-term damage if you get infected by this new type of gonorrhea? What's the long-term damage to the person?
Well, for women, it would be sterility because you'd ruin the uterus and the fallopian tubes, et cetera. And for men, probably something similar. I don't know exactly what the chronic prostatitis, your arthritis is going to do, but to have a chronic pussy infection of your penis or your cervix is not a good thing. It's how we get chronic disease and degenerative disease.
Wow. And there's no antibiotics now that can cure it.
This one subset. Gonorrhea is still treatable, but it's showed up already that there's stuff out there. So pay attention.
All right. So there are a lot of people emailing us. And if you've got a question for Dr. Fred Harvey here on WMNF in Tampa, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Let's go to Gail in Fort Myers, who's been waiting patiently. Hey, Gail, how are you?
Good. How are you?
We're good.
Hey, Gail.
Good. Hi, Dr. Fred. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 65, and I have shingles for the third time.
Ouch.
Yeah, no fun. And I just wanted some advice as to the sores were not very bad, but the nerve pain is not so great. It's clearing up a little bit, but I've read that when you're over 60, you can get post-herpetic neuralgia.
That's right. Anybody can get that, and it's really painful.
I've already got problems with my lungs, and it's wrapped around my lungs, so I just wondered what I can do, anything you can suggest.
Okay. There's some really good things you can do. If you can find a local acupuncturist, they can surround the dragon, so to speak, where that fire is on your flank, and actually can reduce the pain that way. A topical curcumin, if you can find one, or just get a curcumin capsule, open it up and mix it with some coconut oil and rub that around the place. Now, you have to make sure that you don't get that on anything else because it will stain everything bright yellow. And then there are a lot of oral nutritional supplements you can do. Make sure you get enough fish oil. Look at your fish oil bottle, and the front of the bottle is going to say 1,000 milligrams or 1,200 milligrams capsule. Well, that's just the size of the capsule. Flip it around to the back and add up EPA plus DHA, and your goal for that is to get about, when you're in this kind of pain, you want to get 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams of the EPA and DHA a day.
Okay.
And divide that up and take it with food so you don't belch it.
Okay.
And then you want to take oral curcumin too. There are some really good extracts out there. There's one called BCM95. It's a 95% curcuminoid in oil, and it's really highly absorbable, and it's really effective for reducing inflammation. So it can cut the pain, maybe two of those a day. Enzymes, like proteolytic enzymes. I use one called Proteozyme, but even just basic bromelain and papain, if you're not sensitive to pineapple or papaya, those are great enzymes that help with inflammation. And there are other things you can do to support, like supporting your nervous system. We found that a lot of antidepressant class medications help with chronic pain because I think they help with serotonin levels, which help you perceive pain differently. And so you could take some 5-HTP or some tryptophan, which might help with that part of the nervous system to be more resilient. And also another thing you could do really is to consider medication if the pain gets too bad. Gabapentin can help because it changes the way you perceive pain. However, a natural version of that essentially would be something that supports GABA. Gamma aminobutyric acid is your main neurotransmitter that turns off your brain for sleep and turns off some pain perception. And so you can take this stuff called phenylbutyrate or phenibute. I use a brand called Cavanase, but there are others on the market.
I've taken Cavanase, yes.
So Cavanase can work like the gabapentin naturally, so you don't have to take the pharmaceutical. And that can help with your pain perceptions. So all those things can really work towards it. And then to prevent the next one, get the new Shingrix vaccine.
Okay, so you can get that once you've had shingles three times.
You can get it after your first episode, or even without ever having had it, you can get it with the history of chickenpox. So anybody out there who's an adult who has had chickenpox, I would recommend that you consider the Shingrix vaccine for two reasons. One, it seems very safe. It's not made from a live virus. It's made from a protein, surface protein from the virus. So it's rather effective and safe. And I think it's worth it to avoid the postherpetic neuralgia. It's nasty.
Okay, so how long do I have to wait? Since I just got this about 2 weeks ago.
I'd say wait 3 to 6 months until you're completely healed from that and let your immune system come back to baseline.
Okay. So the Cavanase, I have terrible insomnia as well, and I know Cavanase is really good for insomnia, correct?
Yes, indeed. And the fact that you have insomnia would suggest that maybe you do have a low GABA and your pain perception would be higher.
Ah, okay.
So get that Cavanase support on board, that GABA support.
All right. Gail, okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Hope that's helpful.
Bye-bye.
You know, I'm shocked that people can get shingles multiple times. How do you avoid getting shingles, a reinfection?
Get the Shingrix vaccine.
All right.
Really, I think it makes great sense. I've not heard of any adverse consequences yet. Everything we do that's invasive has an adverse consequence. So expect to hear there might be something that happens to somebody who takes this shot.
Is the shingles virus everywhere out there?
Yeah, chickenpox is everywhere.
Okay.
That is the shingles virus. So if you were exposed as a kid to chickenpox, then you have the likelihood of getting shingles as an adult when you get a stressor, whether it's a chemical stress, a spiritual emotional stress, or a physical stress. Any of those will bring it on.
And I wonder about, washing hands or things like that. Is there any, how does that chickenpox virus or the shingles virus, is it done through other people sneezing or is it through?
So chickenpox is sneezing and contact with the serous fluid coming out of the blisters. And shingles, the only way you can transmit that is by direct contact with the fluid coming out of the blisters, because that's where the virus is. So anybody you know that has shingles, you should avoid their open wounds. And kids, at this point, I'm in a debate. I mean, most kids have survived chickenpox, no problem. Some get some scars, but usually they're not that visible later. So should they get the chickenpox vaccine to prevent the need for anything later? It's quite possible. Chickenpox is not a life-threatening illness. And so I believe in vaccines for life-threatening illnesses. I'm not so sure we need that one, but for the pain down the line, it's a consideration.
Well, Dr. Fred Harvey is here. He's an MD, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. He practices functional medicine, and he's here every other Monday. Frank Knox is our phone producer. Let's go to Mandy, who's in Spring Hill, with a question. Hi, Mandy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you so much. I have a question. My mom has COPD, and I heard you in the beginning of the show talking about Mucinex.
Yes.
Which is what her doctor recommended when she has, a lot of phlegm or, like, bronchitis or symptoms that last a long time.
Yes.
What can she do instead of then Mucinex? Can she do the same amendments that you had mentioned?
Yeah, for that kind of thick mucus, I would make sure she gets a lot of fluids every day. And that's something that happens with parents as they get on in years. They don't want to drink so much fluids. But maybe if we boosted a little bit and got her some good chicken broth, some kind of flavor in it. Chicken broth actually has cysteine in it. Cysteine, again, helps with the mucus. And also, whatever is in a good quality chicken broth made with good vegetables, there was a guy at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA Medical Center, pulmonologist, who did a study with his grandmother's Lithuanian chicken soup. And he tested a bunch of people that got a cold. And he used an amazingly detailed test. I don't know how he got people to do this, but he used radionuclide-traced white blood cells. In other words, he tagged these things with a little, slightly radioactive tracer, and he saw that the people that drank grandma's chicken soup had fewer infiltrates, fewer white blood cells in the lungs. So basically what he said is, I proved that we can cure the common cold with chicken soup.
How about that?
So, but it does help with the mucus. And the other thing is N-acetylcysteine, again, 600 milligrams four times a day. If the person tolerates it, some people get queasy with it because there's a lot of sulfur in it. So taking it with food is not a bad idea. And I think pulmonary rehabilitation is a really important thing for anybody who has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
What is that?
That's where you go to the hospital and you hang out with a respiratory therapist, and they give you instructions on how to breathe appropriately and how to clear your lungs well. And so they give you instructions on how to get the mucus out better, how to breathe easier. And I think that's really important. And again, for your mother, have her cut back on dairy because it might increase the mucus. But Mucinex, I don't like it because it doesn't actually directly thin the mucus. What it does is irritate the stomach lining so that your vagus nerve reacts. Your vagus nerves makes peristalsis happen and also makes you secrete more watery fluids. And so it irritates your system. N-acetylcysteine works with your system.
Okay.
Mandy, thanks a lot. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Gina writes this: what are your thoughts on collagen peptide supplements? Can they really improve bone density?
Actually, when you get protein, you're going to work on your bone density. So I don't care whether you get collagen protein peptides or whether you get a slice of nice snapper or a egg or a piece of cheese or some beans. You got protein. And the key is you want to get at least a third of your body weight in protein, in pounds, that is. So 150-pound person, 50 grams of protein a day as maintenance. That's to make sure that you maintain your skin, hair, nails, and bones, and your enzyme systems, and the lining of your gut. Less than a third of your body weight, you're going to be risking losing some of that. So your gut turns over every week. All the cells lining the gut have to turn over because it's very intensive metabolism. If they don't have enough protein, they're going to steal it from the bones. And so we need to get protein to make sure that the bones are healthy. And then we need to make sure that the gut is healthy. Somebody with celiac disease who has a constant turnover of the gut lining every day, they're even more protein intensive than somebody who doesn't have that. And so you really need to get more protein and make sure the gut is healed so you can assimilate the protein, and then you can also keep repairing the rest of the body.
All right, so what if you're a vegan or a vegetarian? Best sources of protein?
Beans.
Okay.
Mixed with grains.
That's
because
what Eve would say.
Because beans and grains go together because they have a slightly different amino acid complement. But yes, you just, there's no other way to get enough that I can see that all the, you know, everything we eat has a little bit of protein in it, but not enough to get to bone health levels. And if somebody really has severe osteoporosis and any other medical illness that tears down the system, I don't know that being vegan is going to get you well. You may be able to go back to it after you heal the osteoporosis, but you need more protein. The key is, I mean, I have a couple of really beautiful patients that, originally were vegan. She had multiple sclerosis, couldn't get out of a wheelchair. We got her on eggs. She walked. We found out she was egg sensitive. She went back to protein powders. She started failing again. And they really tried to do a vegan ketogenic diet, which is really hard. Lots of protein powders, pea and rice protein powders, and hemp protein powders and whatever else they could find. But finally, she ended up eating meat again because she just couldn't get strong enough. She is thriving now. And they don't eat that much.
And because her MS?
And her MS is in remission. And she's getting stronger again. And so the key is that she's basically ketogenic. But the real ketogenic doesn't necessarily need to have tons of meat and cheese curds and pork rinds. Lean, healthy, grass-fed meats, pasture-raised chickens, wild-caught fish. These are healthy additions to the diet for these people that need that support because their body's being torn down. But they still live on 80% plants.
David writes this, and this is a topic, Fred, that you wanted to bring up today. He said, I stopped into a medical marijuana doctor this past weekend, and I got my initial consultation completed. I was surprised how easy the process was, and I'm looking forward to getting my medical marijuana card from the state of Florida. What is the doctor's take on medical marijuana, on the process here in Florida? I don't think he's spoken about it yet on the show. That's David, who's out there in cyberspace.
Good question, David. Thanks for bringing it up. I am a certifying doctor, and I think the process is easier than it was. I think it's kind of a bizarre process. My education for the process was not in anything about cannabis. It was in how to fulfill the state's requirements for me to allow someone to access cannabis. That's all it is. It's like a certifying program. It would be nice if they gave us a little more detail, because they just throw us into it and then they have this order sheet of stuff that's just incomprehensible, essentially, to begin with, because no one really has good data on how to use a topical, how to use an inhalation. I mean, there is obviously anecdotal stuff coming from the states that had already passed these laws, but it was difficult at first. But I've gotten a better understanding about how people are responding to it, so we can talk about it in more detail. The latest snafu in the process is the fact that the people that want to use actual flower material have to come back into my office and fill out a new consent form, because the state found that in its illustrious ill wisdom that when I check the box that says inhalation, that doesn't mean combustation, even though you inhale the combusted product. So now they have to come back in, and I have to attest that they've tried other forms, and there's a medical reason for using the flower form, and that's ridiculous, because it's not a drug, and there's no medical reason specifically for using any specific form. Mm-hmm. So it's just a new hurdle and a new game.
Even though the governor says he wants smokable medical marijuana out there, you can't go into a medical marijuana shop and get smokable marijuana right now, can you?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, you can.
Yeah, okay. They just added this new thing where my patients that want it have to come back to my office. We have to do a face-to-face consult again. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But eventually they'll catch on that it's ridiculous, and they'll probably streamline this a little bit more.
All right, so what if I come to you and say I've got let's say I've got post-traumatic stress, and and I want you to prescribe medical marijuana for me. Who keeps the record that I've got PTSD? Do you keep it, or does the state of Florida keep it?
So the application that goes to the state I believe includes no specific data about why you're using it. The consent form and that stuff remains in the doctor's office as a medical record. The state only has the fact that I've certified and that I have attested to the fact that the consent form remains in my office. But when you sign the consent, it says on the bottom of the form that the state may use and sell even, I think, your unidentified information. So they could release that a 35-year-old man is using medical marijuana, and I'm not sure whether they actually attach the diagnosis to it or not, but they don't put a name with it. There's no identifying factors, but they just want some epidemiologic data about how many people are using it for what.
Okay. Here's an email about the neti pot. James writes, can a neti pot be used when a person has a deviated septum?
Good question. Yes, it's possible. There may be some difficulty depending on how badly deviated the septum is. You may have differences in flow going through. I don't know that I would use it for a perforated septum. That's a question.
What's the difference?
Well, a deviated septum is when you've had your nose broken and it slips to the left or the right. And so one nostril is going to be a little narrower than the other. But a perforated septum is what happens when somebody uses a lot of cocaine and it eats a hole in the middle of the septum. So there's actually a hole, a perforation that goes through. Mm-hmm. That's a little questionable. I'm not sure I want to use it then. That nose might not be feeling too good to do it anyway.
Well, you're listening to the Health and Nutrition Program on 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. Fred Harvey, MD, is with us, and we're going to go to Al in St. Pete, who's been holding for a while. Al, what's your question for Fred?
Yeah, my only question is, my wife has Crohn's.
Yes.
And is there a good tack to take, because she's tried all sorts of remedies?
So I think that all the colitis conditions are related. They have different flavors because of the genetics of where they're going to present and exactly how they'll present. So Crohn's disease is inflammatory bowel disease, and the triggers that we know of out there can be food, bacteria, different infections, but there's no specific causative factor, which is what makes it difficult for Western medicine to treat, because they need to have a specific cause to treat most effectively. So the treatments are generic, and what they are is immunosuppressive treatments in general. What I've witnessed in my practice is that if people get off the offensive dietary items, gluten, dairy, eggs, unfiltered fermented beverages like kombucha and wine, because the yeast byproducts in that may actually incite a problem. So one way of doing it is just very simply following something like the autoimmune protocol diet, which works on many autoimmune diseases. It's a paleo-type diet where you eat lean meat and greens, no beans, no dairy, no grains. But there's also another one called the specific carbohydrate diet, SCD. And that one has you eliminate a group of different sugars. And we're finding things are going both ways. There's a whole dietary plan called the low FODMAP plan, F-O-D-M-A-P, and that's an acronym for a bunch of different kinds of sugars and starches, fructose, and so that's what it starts with. And so these sugars and starches can promote growth of yeast, which yeast byproducts irritate the colon in many cases. So dietary changes are the definite start. And you could find a functional medicine doctor to help with food sensitivity testing. If that doesn't work, do stool testing differently than what the gastroenterologist does, because functional stool testing looks at different things that they aren't interested in.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Al, thank you. Thank you. Good luck with your wife. And let's go to Susan in Sarasota. Susan, what's your question for Dr. Fred Harvey?
Hi, Dr. Harvey. I've spoken to you before. I told you about my sleep apnea, severe osteoporosis, diastolic dysfunction, and valve.
Yes.
Yes, I've got a lot of things. Number one, I have a low thyroid that I'm always playing around with, biotic, GTA, and Medistim. And lately it's gotten a little higher, and I'm very frightened of all the medications. I've looked into all of them. If I take one of the more natural ones, the T3 in it and all that, could make me more anxious. And I'm concerned about fillers, and I'm concerned about losing more bone. But I'm wondering if you think, because you're awfully bright, if you think having a low thyroid could have some effect on the diastolic dysfunction.
Well, that's a good question. And yes, thyroid will have effect on the cardiac pump function. The question is, are you in the truly hypothyroid range or just in the marginal function range? Is your TSH over 10?
Never been over 10.
Is it over 6?
No. Once, many years ago, it was a 7. This latest time was very unusual. It was 5 point something.
Yeah, it sounds like you hover right on the edge of fully functional. So has anybody checked you for Hashimoto's disease?
Once my antibodies weren't good and once...
Well, then, if the antibodies weren't good, you have Hashimoto's and you should always avoid gluten. You might consider avoiding dairy, too.
Oh,
and
I do. I'm a pure vegan. I don't know after this show, but I'm vegan.
Okay, so that sounds like you need to have a bit further evaluation to figure out why you hover on the edge of hypothyroidism with a functional doctor.
Why do I hover on the edge?
Yeah, that's the question that the functional doctor needs to answer, because it's pretty tough to do it via a radio show, because this gets really complex when you're hovering on the edge of functionality.
What kind of test would someone do?
Well, you could do a broad-based thyroid panel that includes the reverse T3. Look again at the thyroid hormone or the thyroid antibodies, the anti-thyroid antibodies. Look at the cortisol levels because they come into it, the sex hormone levels, and then look at toxicity and also nutrient deficiency or excess. Because if you don't have enough selenium, you can't convert the thyroid hormone. If you don't have enough zinc and copper, you can't convert the thyroid hormone. And so, yeah, there's a lot of things that come into it. So it really requires an in-depth eval.
Spectracell, I think you mentioned one.
Spectracell's one, Vibrant America's micronutrient test, the Genova NutriVal. There's all kinds of ways to skin the onion, but that is a long-term conversation, my dear.
All right. Well,
I put myself and my boyfriend on 720 CoQ10 because it's ubiquinone.
Yeah.
Think that I'm doing a disservice to either of us?
Well, I think you're just wasting your money. It's a bit high dose.
Okay. And I've decided to forget the Arjuna because it looks like it's pretty potent. Do you agree?
I don't use much Arjuna, so not much comment on that.
All right. Listen, I have loved talking to you. I think you're a brilliant young man.
Well, thank you, my dear. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Susan. Good to hear from you. Kylie writes this, Fred. Any advice for someone addicted to nasal sprays? I have terrible seasonal allergies and also my pet dog and cats, not an option to get rid of them. My nose gets stuffed every day to the point that nasal spray is my only relief. My grandma is hooked on nasal spray, and so is my mom, and she passed it on to me. I know these products are not good for long-term use, and I would like to break from my habit, but I don't know where to start.
Excellent question. So I'm guessing that you're addicted to the decongestant nasal sprays like neosinephrine or Afrin or things like that. And they are highly addictive. When you try to stop them, you get a rebound that's horrendous and you can't breathe at all. And what you've got is something called, in Latin, rhinitis medicamentosa, inflamed nasal passages from medicine. It's a very bad adverse consequence. So, neti pot to clean out the toxin. Flonase or some other nasal steroid to help. And then you need antihistamines because you need something to help block it, and you need decongestant to do systemically to get off the nasal decongestant. So phenylephrine or Sudafed PE is a great way to do that without getting too jazzed from Sudafed. I can't stand Sudafed. It's like speed. And then one of the non-sedating antihistamines like fexofenadine, otherwise known as Allegra, 180 milligrams extended release, at least one a day, maybe two a day to get this calm so you can get off of it. But you're going to be needing to use the steroids every day for at least a week before you can begin the process because you got to calm the nose down. And then you can start tapering off the nasal spray. And it's going to be a several-week event. And you're going to have days where you really are not happy, but you'll get through it.
So is there long-term danger for using steroids in your nose like Flonase?
Generally not, because they're extremely low dose. Not a lot gets absorbed and systemic, but if you have other medical problems and you're on other medications, like there was a patient that Eve and I shared that had both HIV and hepatitis C and was on numerous antiviral medications, and somehow her liver did not process the synthetic steroid, and she got Cushing's syndrome from using nasal steroids. It's the only case I've ever heard of where people got that kind of reaction. But after you get off of the decongestant nasal spray, then you can start tapering off the steroid nasal spray. And once you feel clear enough, then you can go to like every, like maybe skip it twice a week and then skip it every other day.
This sounds like it should be done under a doctor's supervision.
It would be best that way.
Yeah.
But the thing is, these are low-level interventions, and they're all over the counter, so you could probably get away with it without actually seeing the doctor. But if you really want help, find a functional doctor, because you might find a really good ENT, and I haven't had discussions with them recently about this. I haven't seen much of it recently, but a good ENT should be able to help you taper off too, because they don't want you to be taking these things. They're poison.
Yeah. This email comes in from Gary. He says, what is your opinion of the health benefits of licorice root? The DGL licorice root is said to be safer, but are the nutrients reduced in the DGL process? And is there any truth about it helping with hepatitis B or C?
That's a great question, or many questions, actually. So, licorice root, been used for millennia for human health and also for delight. I love a good black licorice. So, licorice root has really two medicinal uses. One is for building up your adrenals, and that only works if you have pure licorice root, because there's something in that called glycyrrhizic acid, and glycyrrhizic acid acts like a hormone of a sort and triggers the adrenal to be stronger. So it can actually raise your blood pressure, and it can actually cause, I believe it's high potassium. I have to look at that. Haven't seen a licorice toxicity recently, but so it will alter the way your kidneys function and the way you get blood pressure. So it supports the adrenals. On the other hand, DGL, deglycerized licorice, is not going to do that, so it's safer hormonally. And you can use it for longer periods of time, and you don't need to monitor the blood pressure with it. But anybody who's doing straight-up licorice root as an extract should be followed by a doctor for that one, because it is a medicine. But the DGL itself, it's a great healer for the gut. So I use it for heartburn, for queasy stomach. It's a really nice soother. So,
does it help with hepatitis B or C?
I've not seen direct evidence, but licorice is an adaptogen. So if your adrenals get stronger, your immune system may be stronger, and then you may have more resilience to the virus. But I've not seen any kind of direct antiviral reports on it.
Let's take another phone call. You're listening to the Health and Nutrition Program on 88.5 FM. And let's go to Carolyn, who's in Plant City. Hi, Carolyn.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question. I'm sorry to go back to the chicken pox.
Oh, move around. That's good.
But there's three of us, my wife and her mother, who's in advanced age, like going to be 92 this year. Both of them have had chickenpox in their life, but I was told that even though I haven't, that I may have been exposed and didn't know it. So is there a negative for me if I didn't have chickenpox as a child? But, you know, we don't know if we've been exposed, right? I mean,
well, most of us were exposed. Did you actually get enough to mount an immune response? The one way you can know is go to your doctor and ask them to do a varicella antibody titer. And that way you know that you have immunity to chickenpox, but you don't have then immunity to shingles. So if you have the antibody to varicella, it means you are predisposed to getting shingles. So I would get the Shingrix vaccine based on that.
So you wouldn't get it if I didn't take that test?
Well, actually, I would talk to the doctor about it. I wouldn't make that decision over the airwaves for that one, because the issue is that if you have not had chickenpox, it's probably better to get the live virus vaccine that's for the chickenpox for kids, so that you can actually get the immunity to the virus itself, not to the recurrence of the virus, which is the Shingrix. I don't know if Shingrix prevents the first infection.
Oh, okay. And in terms of someone with advanced age, who's otherwise good health, is there any negative? I mean, I know what you said, you know, there might be coming out, you know, here and there, but in general, is there an issue with someone's age?
No age-related problems. Immunocompromise is another issue, and that can happen with age and other reasons, but the only vaccine in this group that would be a problem would be the original shingles vaccine, Zostrix, I think it was called, or Zostavax. And Zostavax is a live virus, attenuated, so you don't want to take that if you have immunocompromise, but if your mom's healthy otherwise, she's good for Shingrix.
Okay, great. Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
You're real
All
welcome.
Right, Carolyn, thank you.
Y'all have a good day.
You too. Thanks a lot. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Bill writes this: I've got all the symptoms of polymyositis.
Polymyositis, yes.
Polymyositis, okay. Looks like there's no way out but into the grave. Do you have a comment about that, writes Bill? What is polymyositis?
Polymyositis is an autoimmune disease. And so what it means is the body's attacking itself for an unknown reason. And poly means many. Myo is muscle. Itis is inflammation. So many muscles are inflamed. These people feel like their whole body's on fire and can't move. Any movement hurts. It's worse than fibromyalgia because it's actually in the muscles and not just a pain signal. It's the muscles are getting unraveled. And so, yes, there are answers, but you need to find out what's triggering it. In functional medicine, we talk about antecedents, triggers, and mediators. And so your antecedent is you have some genes that are set up there that would predispose you to getting polymyositis. mastocytosis. Something triggered it. Was it a virus? Was it a food you were eating? Was it a toxin? We don't know. We can explore, but sometimes it doesn't matter unless the trigger keeps doing it to you. But try to eliminate many triggers, and one of the ways to do that is do the autoimmune protocol diet, which eliminates many food triggers. And it's working to put to bed things like multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis. Another thing you should do right away is get on CBD. Get a good quality organic CBD product that's full spectrum and do at least 10 milligrams three times a day to start. But if you feel uncomfortable with that, start with 5 milligrams. But I've seen most people do 10 quite easily, and they start to step down the inflammation.
You talked about nutrition, but what things that you might be eating, but what about environmental? I mean, is it possibly linked to the environment that you live in?
So true. And so if you have any mold in your house, it's quite possible mold is a trigger. I've seen so many autoimmune diseases triggered by mold. It's worth it to look around. If you find black anywhere, you might want to get a deeper evaluation. There are tests you can do on your body for mold toxins to see if they're in there, and there are tests you can do on your house if there are mold tests. Mold toxins in the house. I use a company called Real Time Labs because they have an FDA-approved, patented method of looking at this stuff. It's the only one on the market that's actually FDA-approved and patented for this specific issue. There are many other test companies that do it, and many people around the area bring out a petri dish and see if they can grow mold from your house. But if you ever left a bowl of food out, you know that you're going to grow mold around your house. It's a very ineffective method of doing it. Real-time laboratories can help with that. And then there are other things like infections. So you should think about your gut. If it's a problem, there could be parasites or bacteria there that are stimulating problems. It's multi-layered. We need to look deep. So you need a functional medicine doctor to help dig you out of this autoimmune hole, because Western medicine doesn't have the time or the focus to find what's causing it. They just want to put it to rest, which is also good, because if you're burning up from polymyositis, let the rheumatologist give you the medicine that's going to put you to bed and then fix the reason.
Let's go to Bill in Largo. Hey, Bill, you're on WMNF. Hi, Bill.
Oh.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning. My question is about CBD oil and what it is, and then how is it different from the tincture one might get at a marijuana dispensary? And then what would you prescribe if somebody is certified to get medical marijuana? What would you suggest for, say, chronic pain?
So what do you know what the source of the chronic pain is? And where is the pain? All over? Back?
It's knee, ankle, joint, mostly from previous injuries, and I think it's arthritic.
So I think a baseline of maybe something like a topical 1-to-1 CBD THC patch that delivers the dose over several days might be something to take the edge off. But starting with just CBD and maybe a little bit of THC for depending on when your pain is worst, that's another option. The CBD 1-to-1 tincture also is an option. But I think CBD should be in the mix to begin with, just because it's chronic pain and that causes stress, and the CBD will cut that down a bit. And then if you have really bad pain, the inhaled THC works really pretty fast, but it does sedate you more. So you kind of got to play around with what your body likes.
And is it the patient that plays around with it, or is it the doctor who kind of plays around with it for the patient?
I think most of the time, from what I've heard from patients that have come to me already certified, is that the patient gets to do it. The doctor gives them some recommendations. But, you know, there's not a lot of data for the doctors that are doing this for how to recommend it. And so it makes it a little difficult, but if you just use a little bit of logic with it, you know, if you have a muscle on your right shoulder that hurts and you have a topical cream, just apply it there and see if that does it. That way you don't have to take it systemically and sedate yourself. It's
so the CBD oil, does that have THC in it, or it doesn't, and the tincture from the dispensary does have THC? Is that the difference?
So it's really interesting, yes. Yeah. So when I have been into my favorite local CBD shop, they have full spectrum. There's less than 0.3% THC, but it's in there. However, what's really weird is that when you go to the dispensary, it is 100% CBD. There is no full spectrum. You get a CBD tincture. It's really interesting that it's not full spectrum, but they do throw a couple of terpenes from the hemp back into it. But it's interesting that they don't do full spectrum, but the not regulated market does full spectrum. But I think that market is soon to be regulated. There's a movement going on across the country, and including in Sarasota. City of Sarasota has banned the sale of CBD within the city limits because there were a lot of questionable dealers selling this stuff, and we don't know what's in it. So, you know, the medical industry is really regulated. Every product is tested. You know exactly what's in the bottle. But there's such a big profit margin on the CBD that the stuff that's showing up could be, you know, safflower oil with some hemp flavoring or something. Nobody has any idea what's, because there's no regulation of it. So it's best actually to actually get it from the medical cannabis dispensary if you can. But otherwise, find a really good source that does their research and gets 100% organic, and it's tested, third-party tested for mold toxins, because they're using industrial moldy hemp in some of these products. Mm. Scary.
All right, Bill, there
okay,
you go.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks,
you're
Bill.
You're welcome.
Well, we have more than a dozen more questions. We've got people on the line. Here's one of the questions that came in. Nina writes, I'm 63 years old and taking a comprehensive bone support with MCHC. Should I take vitamin K2 also? That's a question.
That's a good question. MCHC, microcrystalline hydroxyapatite calcium. That is bone calcium. Derived from usually lamb bones or veal bones. So if you're a vegan, you're not going to be doing MCHC. But it's a great source because it's exactly what's in our bones. And so the body uses it appropriately. K2 also supports the metabolism of calcium in the body. Helps with the absorption distribution. And so that would be a really good thing to add to vitamin D. And I've been switching many of my patients over to a K2 D3 supplement because they're both oil-based, so you can just deliver it in one pill instead.
James writes this, I can't find a pharmacy that has the new two-part shingle vaccine. There are 100 people on the waiting list. Any suggestions?
Wow. Had no idea it was that bad. I just recommend people to go. I don't write prescriptions anymore because the government's given it all to pharmacies, and I just recommend people get it. I haven't heard the story, so I called different pharmacies, private ones, small independent ones may still have some, but you know, Walgreens and CVS, they sell a lot of products, so they could probably be out, but if you find an independent, you might find something there.
Patrick writes this, the chickenpox virus lives in your spinal cells after you get it. It's reactivated somehow to come out as shingles in the peripheral nerves and skin. He just wants to add his knowledge. Is that true?
And that is true, yes. Yeah. That's why it's a problem. Once you've had chickenpox, the ganglia, which is groups of cells by your spinal cord, hold on to this virus. They reside there. And whenever you get a stress, like if you get an emotional stress or you get an infection, you may see this come out.
Thanks to James in Largo, who just made a $120 contribution. James, thank you, supporting sustainable living and the Alternative Health Program. Here's an email. Anonymous says, another medical marijuana question. I don't want to smoke it, so I make brownies with the concentrate. Any suggestions for a more healthy treat?
Well, I would suggest don't bother. Just use the tincture under your tongue. It works pretty nicely. And that way, if you can put up with the flavor of it, which doesn't taste that bad, you could really...
Do you know what the dose is? I mean, what is the dose?
Well, the tinctures are varying in dosing between the companies, but once you get the bottle, they can instruct you into exactly how many milligrams there are per drop or per dropper full, and that way you can gauge it. And if you're using THC, I would never start with more than 5 milligrams for somebody new to it, even 2 milligrams for somebody who's completely naive to cannabinoids, just to see how it affects. But I have a problem with the, and I'm glad that the state of Florida did not legalize edibles. A lot of people are not happy with that, but I have seen edibles on the market of like 150 milligrams in an Oreo cookie. I know of no human that has ever eaten a tenth or a 20th of an Oreo cookie. It makes no sense to me. We eat whole cookies. And so to put that big a dose in and make it available to the general public, unless you're a complete stoner and want to be just laying around dazed all day, 150 milligrams is only for somebody who's got terminal cancer, essentially, from what I've seen and witnessed in patients. So I don't like the edible because people end up eating too much. I watched a friend of mine one time grab one at a party, and he went paranoid, just like the man in Canada at Toronto, an 80-year-old gentleman, went into a recreational facility, got an 80-milligram lollipop, and ate the whole thing. He had hallucinosis, paranoid feelings, and had a heart attack because it scared the heck out of him.
So the manufacturers are being irresponsible and putting too much THC.
There are some stoners that can deal with that dose. That's okay. The problem. It's like, so once we make it recreational, we have to be really careful about guarding these potent drugs.
Yeah. Safety Harbor just made a $60 contribution to WMNF. Thank you, Ann. Fred, we're out of time. I wish we had more time.
It's amazing
how
fast it goes.
Yeah. So I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Excellent.
All right.
Dr.
Fred Harvey has been here for the past hour answering your questions about health and nutrition. He will be back in 2 weeks at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning. And next week in this time slot, you'll hear the Sustainable Living Program. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Stay tuned for Radioactivity.